very pleased to have two guests from Grant Thornton, which is a global CPA firm. The first on my over here, Len Pape, is the New England Assistant Managing Partner and Lead of Industry Groups and Markets. Len leads New England's construction, real estate, hospitality, and restaurant practices. He has a Bachelor of Arts in Economics from the College of Holy Cross, Master of Science from Bentley University, and is an adjunct professor at Bentley University. Ben Brands is the director of the National Private Equity Services, so his territory is the United States.
The entire world.
The world?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. When did you get promoted?
Really?
Len just promoted me.
I did.
Yeah, even better.
Ben's got 20 years experience as a private equity manager, a transaction specialist, and strategic advisor. He's led new business development and investment officers. He completed over $1 billion in transactions as lead investor. So he has served on the boards of numerous private companies, including Smart City Networks, U.S. Cable, and the New York Press. He's got a Bachelor of Science in Economics from the Wharton School and an MBA from the University of Chicago. So I'm going to get out of the way and let you two take over.
Okay. I need my pen back.
Oh, damn. Thought you hadn't noticed.
There you go. So we'll hand out these. These will help facilitate a discussion. Then Len will start off.
Sure. Well, again, my name's Len Pape. By trade, I'm an audit partner of a public accounting firm called Grant Thornton, which I'm sure many of you have worked with audit partners in the past. Many of the Big Four accounting firms, smaller firms, regional firms, but much of what we do centers around the transfer of wealth through various transactions. And what we're going to address today, and one of our main business lines is what we call forensic and valuation services. And many times our forensic and valuation services are called in when there are post-acquisition disputes. And so my understanding of our discussion today has to do with what went wrong with the deal that you just transacted upon. And many times, me being an audit partner, I'm involved in the working capital adjustments after the transaction has been executed. Many times I'm involved pre-closing with assisting in the documentation that's prepared to make sure that the pricing is right. I work with the valuation people to see that, in fact, the value of what's been presented in a willing buyer, willing seller transaction is reasonable. And of course, I help in the post-historical recording of these transactions with the financial statement entries and the like. So I think an audit partner may be a pretty good person to help generate some of the discussion here that we have. And I know, Ellen, I've been introduced to you through on the phone, I believe, through Joel Anik.
Right.
And Joel's one of our favorite partners in the New England area. Anyway, this is going to be an interactive discussion. It's certainly not going to be a one-sided situation. Ben's going to help us with drawing out some of the information that we're going to be using tonight. But we want it to be interactive, and we want it to be a learning process so that you can walk away with something of value. I listened to the CEO of Iron Mountain a few years ago, and he had a list. He was doing a breakfast presentation. He's done about 225 deals. And he had a list of the 10 top items that you should be aware of when doing a deal. Of course, there were 12 items on the list, but being an accountant, it really upset me that they were called 10 and they were 12, and the anxiety was overwhelming. But one of the issues that he had on there, which I have never forgotten in the past, I don't know how many years it's been since I've heard him, that just stood out, and it's typical of not being intimidated by a deal. It's typical of being a common sense, street smart person. And he said, bad people sell bad companies. And he said, if the CEO of the company that you're buying cheats on his wife and cheats on his taxes and is bad to his kids, don't buy the company. It's as simple as that. And he had little quips and quotes that were similar to that. But the point of my story is, you don't have to be a CPA or a financial analyst or somebody that understands derivatives in order to understand the buying and selling of businesses and understanding why businesses that are sold sometimes come out on the other end as not a good deal. And that's what we're trying to get to today. Common sense, all questions are reasonable and good. Let's just have some fun and see what, where Ben takes us. So if you have your little placemat here, would like to get a little bit of a rundown. If how many people have served on a public or a private board here? If you could raise your hand. So 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14 people have served on board. So you understand the importance of board decisions, independent board governance, and all the things that go along with boards. So everybody's very familiar with many of these issues. Did the company that you were involved in on the board, did the board make acquisitions that you were on? Of course, Ellen has. Anyone? Sure. Few, four.
And before I go on, so out of the four people that worked on a company that they were a board member that did an acquisition, were you personally involved in that acquisition in any capacity?
Sure.
So everyone who served on board was involved in that acquisition, that an acquisition. Okay. Good.
Anybody, do you want me to just go through the questions, Ben?
Yep.
And you don't have to have sold a company or been on a board that sold a company, but what do you think the most important and major post-acquisition issues are? After the deal is signed, after the closing date has happened, you now own a company. What do you think some of the most important issues that are facing a board of directors or an organization are? You hold off from it. You've been through too many wars. Yeah?
Cultural alignment.
Great. Yeah, great question. Great answer. Cultural alignment, of course, is, you know, what we think as well. Even as, you know, number cruncher types, culture's everything.
I guess related to that is leadership.
Yeah?
I would think integration is absolutely important. First, before some of the other.
Integration, right.
Talent leakage. At all levels, not just at the leadership
yep.
level.
And the integration is important with the cultural part of things, too. Cultural integration is key. I'm sorry?
Managerial competence. Whoever's left out. Particularly at the mid-levels.
What was that?
Skeletons in the closet.
Right.
Diligence.
That's where your due diligence boys and girls come in.
Or didn't
come in.
Right. What do you call I call it like the undisclosed goals. You've done due diligence, but now there's always surprises. How do you term that?
We call that always surprises. Don't we?
Good.
I think we do. Because there are always surprises.
Yep.
And that's where contingencies come in.
That's right.
You know, you need that 90-day window of workout for, you know, working capital adjustments and you know, Ellen?
Well, I think everybody's hit the big ones, and I just go with the whole question a little differently, which is that before you get to the post-acquisition issues, what should you be doing before you actually close the deal?
Yep.
Which is really
that's right.
Comes into the whole integration planning, cultural alignment, how do you drive leadership? I mean, it's everything everyone said. It's just, well, the only thing I would do is turn it on its head and say,
you bet.
Those are the things we should be thinking about before the deal crosses
yep.
the finish line. Because you want the day it crosses the finish line to be
easy.
Know,
yep.
You know,
clean and cut.
Roll,
yep.
Right?
Would you mind summarizing what Ellen said for our home team audience?
Sorry.
Let me just turn it toward Ellen a little better. There you go. What Ellen really said was, you know, all the things that we talked about post-deal should be addressed pre-deal in all of the, you know, I call it good fences make good neighbors. You know, every dollar that you spend for good legal counsel is comes back to you tenfold if you hire a very experienced, industry savvy law firm. Same with the due diligence team on the accounting side, on the tax side, on the legal side. Again,
and on the people side.
And on
the
people side.
Cultural leadership.
Yeah.
Think through once you've caught the fire truck, what are you going to really do with it?
Right.
How are you going to integrate it? How are you going to use the people? How are you going to identify the best people?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a tech company, you don't want them walking out the door 2 days later.
Right? That's right. Yeah.
I think what's harder is when you have, particularly if you're buying a company that's being run by the people who founded it.
Sure.
And they're still very enthusiastic and they, you know.
Yeah.
And they have, to some degree, a little bit of tunnel vision about their company. And they have things they've probably been blind about for years that they're not even looking at anymore, that they're not even thinking to tell you. That if you're really good, you'll find in diligence, but you probably won't find until after the acquisition. And it's not because they're bad people.
No.
It's just because of their worldview.
We usually say that only about 60% of a deal should be relied upon through the financial, accounting, and legal group, because the other 40% or 50% or whatever the number is intangible, is cloudy, is untouchable. You know, and that's where you really have to get that cultural aspect going. But, you know, part of it, and again, the bad people sell bad businesses comment had to do with not being a financial expert, but being a commonsensical type person to understand business a little bit better. Robert?
Where does the objective of the acquirer come in? I used to work for a serial acquirer. It was about accretive earnings. It was about access to customers. There wasn't much else. They didn't really care too much about the people being retained.
Yep.
There were a whole range of things, and they were fairly clear about it.
What was the industry?
Tech. The tech industry.
IP.
And, well, there was a little bit of IP. It was actually more services. Pardon me, so it was tech services. But my question is, how does that play in? Because depending upon what your objective as the acquirer is, that's then going to predicate all the questions that you ask and what you hope to get out of the other end, in spite of some of the surprises.
Yep.
Does that bake into this somewhere?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I was going to say that, you know, when you're concentrating on an acquisition and you're developing your agreements, and you're spending your time and energy as a board member on what acquisition that you want, you know, what aspects of that acquisition are important. There are agreements for the purchase of the acquisition that determine the purchase price adjustments, as Len just mentioned, and agreements that keep on the employees that you want to keep. If the company is not that reliant on human capital, or the owners don't have as much say in, you know, what the human capital does, they're going to be concentrating more on the agreements that work on the purchase price adjustments. That's where, as a board member, you're going to focus your time and energy. Okay. However, if you do need that human capital, and that's an important consideration for you, you know, then you can determine that as a board member, as an owner of a company, whether you're a venture capital firm or private equity firm, where to concentrate your resources. So to me, it's a resource allocation. It's not what's necessarily important, you know, to the end result. It's really kind of what you want out of your company.
Well, I do want to throw in one other element to it. If the reason for the acquisition is, I'll use the word synergy, in other words, there's something other than just we're buying a customer list, then in effect, you're starting a new company. You better quickly find out whether that synergy is really there, whether their product that they have that you think you can cross-sell to your customers, you know, is that really going to work? And, you know, like any other startup, test those really fast and find out if it's going to work, how do you make it work? If it's not going to work, is there some other way of making what we work value out of the assumption that we've just got?
Mm-hmm. Mike?
Well, both of these remarks are kind of in the domain that I was going to bring up, and that is the acquisition done as part of a growth strategy or part of a diversification strategy? Mm-hmm. Because from deals that I've seen, when they fall in the second bucket, again, personal experience, they've been far more problematic, because the people who are in charge of, you know, all of the kinds of things that we talked about before, whether it's value assessment or integration or you name it, they come into the exercise with a framework for looking at it that is unique to the, their industry, their business. And when they're acquiring for diversification, very often they're looking at things in ways that are incorrect, and they don't figure that out until well into the problems that
sure.
are.
They're focused on their industry specialty rather than on the diversification of the new business line, for instance.
Right.
Yeah.
And it underscores cultural differences and people value.
Mm-hmm.
You may be misvaluing a lot of people, because in your business, certain roles have a very different profile of valuation
sure.
than in this business.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood. Well said.
Fabio. Well, I have a comment. When I think of the question, what were the major post-acquisition issues? My experience has been what I call the hidden agenda.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the toughest part, because normally I've been on the side of selling the company rather than buying it. But what you deal with afterwards is what is not seen. So whoever is going to buy you, or when you buy a company, you have a strategy. And not necessarily you disclose it up front. And not necessarily it's clearly stated what it is that you want to do with this company. So the fear of the acquired employees and the team, whether it's valuable or not, it's always on the edge, right? So what's going to happen to me? And then you see people, okay, I have to look for a new job. They're going to shut us down. They're going to move operations overseas. So that's been, for me, the biggest challenge that I've experienced.
Yep. The hidden agenda.
The
sure.
hidden agenda.
There's a cost and a price.
Right.
On both ends.
And the experience has proven there is always an hidden agenda somewhere.
Always, yeah. No, thank you.
So I think a question that could come out of that is that, what do you do about hidden agendas? There's probably hidden agendas in almost every deal
right.
that are very difficult to identify. Can that be solved through due diligence? Can it be solved by an awesome definitive purchase price agreement? Can it be solved by your management team that you trust?
Or don't trust.
So that's a question, I don't know the answer to that. That's a question of the group.
I think the biggest challenge would be to uncover the hidden agenda. Because only when you uncover it, then you eventually know how to fix it. Or you may try to fix it.
Okay. Right. And that's where business discussion comes in. Again, the due diligence can only take you so far, and then it's understanding the smell and feel and sitting at the company. And we just finished a due diligence project with a very large millwork company, and I took the owner around the millwork factory, and I was talking to these wonderful millworkers, these great Italian guys from Rome, and just wonderful woodworkers. And as we walked around, I'm the accountant, I'm speaking to the woodworkers. And the owner of the company did not know the names and the family situations of these. Their hands were, you know, just working the wood. And he didn't know these guys that had worked there 15, 20 years, know them well enough, know their families, what was going on. And we were asking them little questions as I was going through, and, you know, what's your family like, and how long you been here, and what's this gentleman, you know, how's he treated you, and this and that. We get out of that meeting after all financial due diligence was done, tax, legal. We just told him don't buy the company. And it was right. You know, 6 months later, the company was doing badly, and, you know, that was just a smell test, a listening, you know, hidden agenda stuff. But that's the thing that counts. It's not all about the numbers. Sorry.
That's perfect. Is there anything, as we look at this list, and everybody has commented on the items that are critical to evaluating deal, even before looking at this page, right? Is there anything that's missing?
So, back up a minute. So, I think Fabio's comment was really more from the perspective of the company being acquired, that the acquirer has hidden agendas that you're not privy to.
Mm-hmm.
Has hidden agendas price, to even figure out what those are, do you have a responsibility to the employees or whatever to do that or not? I think that's a really interesting question to ask.
I wonder, like, how much of that, and I'm just questioning this here, how much of that probably depends also on, like, what the you know, what the role is in the new, you know, post-acquisition, because, like, to, I didn't catch your name, but to what
Mike?
You said, Michael, like, the difference between sort of, like, a, you know, diversification, you know, strategy versus a growth strategy, you know, if the, you know, the organization being acquired is thinking, like, it's, you know, it's our payday, here we go, but, you know, the acquirer is like, I'm just doing this to, like, get a, you know, that the expectations.
I'm doing it to flip it or, you know,
yeah,
something
exactly,
else.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So,
but,
like,
but if we're talking about our roles as directors, I'm sort of more interested in the question, if you're on the board of the company being acquired, what should you care about those hidden agendas or not? Because you really have several constituencies. You have the owners of the company being sold, whether it's a public or private company. But you also have the employee population, who are the ones who typically get whacked by the hidden agendas, not the people who take the check and go to the bank.
We try to interview the board before that happens to find out, before the terms of an agreement are written, to find out what matters to them. You know, the survival of how much of the employee base does it matter to you? Do you want to have employment contracts with key employees, or does it not matter to you? What about the board itself? Because at acquisition date, you're done. It's over.
Right.
Does the board matter as to their existence on a go-forward basis? So all these things with the attorneys, mostly the attorneys, do, it, I think, a proper interview process of the board way before, on a strategic basis, before these documents are written, as to what matters to that board on a cultural, on an employee, on a continuance basis, rather than just, if it's just a number and a big down payment or an earnout, those are two numbers, it's a whole different ballgame. Otherwise, you don't have any worries. It's just about the dollar. And we try to find that out.
And the sad point, this is a very sad statement, is if you look at the law for a public company, if it's a huge premium, it's all cash, you know, so there's, it's a clear win, you know, it's a clear answer to the board.
Take the
board
money.
Takes the money and run, it's 100% cash.
Very
it's
clear.
When it becomes, when it's equity is involved, then all of a sudden the board, whether you're public or private, but even if you're public, you can sit back and say, you can start to think about the other constituents, if you will, because equity isn't the, you know, the way the law reads, equity isn't a clear, you know, divider, you know.
That's right. It's a volatile issue, yeah.
So. But, you know, management often thinks that the deals that they make with whoever's buying them will last post acquisition, and they almost never do.
They seldom do.
Right.
Very rare.
Very rare, yeah.
Janice had a comment over the corner.
I was just going to say, back to the earlier point, I think the obligation is to at least try to uncover the hidden agendas so you're aware of what you're dealing with. You may, at the end of the day, make the same decision because it's, you know, fiduciary responsibility under a cash offer, etc. But at least if you know what you're dealing with, you could then, as a board member, look to what are some of the other things that perhaps we can do. Is there ways to affect communication to the employee group, or at least to the acquirer, in terms of how that's handled? Is there anything we can do? It may not alter our decision process, but it seems to me at least striving for that knowledge is always important, regardless of what the outcome will be.
Ben, you'd ask for any last thing?
Well, I would just say that it's very difficult as the target company to uncover the hidden agenda, because there's always asymmetric information between buyer and seller.
Right.
So the question is, if you know that it's that difficult, how much time and effort as a board member of that target do you spend attempting to find it, as opposed to the other things that you could be doing as a board member to protect your employees or protect your shareholders? So it's just very hard.
I had one more comment to your question a while ago. This is as the acquirers board. One of the danger would be the team is falling in love with the acquisition. Run past all the warning signs, run past the where it doesn't make sense anymore, selling it to the board beyond what they should have. I think that's one of the super dangers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remove the emotion from the transaction. That's a hard thing to do. Because once that train starts, boy, it's tough to stop. Really tough.
That's that whole deeply on the acquiring, on the side of being acquired as well.
You
get super excited about.
Well, you know, your rule about the smell test also works if you're selling the company. If you look at the potential acquirer and they're, in some sense, bad people, you have to walk away from it sometimes, no matter how much money is involved.
Yeah, we just had a deal blow up in the 11th hour, 59th minute of what we thought was going to be a big deal, and it really exploded. But, you know, there are huge breakup fees, too, when those things happen, because so many people put so much money into these things. But the key thing was it just didn't feel right to the acquired firm, and they killed it, and that's okay. But if you don't feel right, then, stop.
So I have a question about warning signs and how – get that far without some triggers before that.
The key is what Craig said. It's about emotion. This railroad thing, it just is so difficult to extract the emotion out of these deals. People are doing calculations on their calculators of price per share times number of shares they hold, and they keep looking at it, and they think about their bank accounts, they think about their vacation homes, they think about, they're really thinking about material things a lot of times, and you're trying to extract that emotion to make it a real, a real deal, but it's hard to do, and I think that's one of the biggest problems, right, Ellen?
Well, there are.
I joke about this. My term is, it's the me, myself, and I syndrome that occurs. Whether you're the being acquired or whether you're the acquirer, it always comes down to individuals and people, and people are always thinking about, how am I going to be affected? Whether it's dollars in the bank, or am I going to have a job the next day? And both sides.
You bet.
Well, you've also brought in third parties whose job it is to get a deal done, right? And so they're going to have a hard time walking away and admitting failure.
That's right.
Well, but at the end of the day, they get paid.
You know, what in this discussion,
they might not get rehired.
Rehired's good. Rehired's good.
Well, in a way, this discussion is about decision making with imperfect information.
Yes.
And so, none of these deals are done with perfect information, and that's what we're kind of acknowledging here. And one of the questions is, at what point do you have enough? And then what do you do about the uncertainties that you say, all right, we're not really going to know, these 10 things with any certainty. And so we write those out. And, okay, well, what happens if this doesn't turn out? So there's representation.
That's 40% I was talking about.
And so to some extent, there's some practice of buying insurance over these things, all sort of stuff. I mean, that's the question for the table. Is how do we say enough is enough and we're ready to go ahead? I mean, that's...
But every business decision is a decision in the presence of insufficient information, not just an acquisition or sale decision. So you either have good practices about how do I make decisions about a new product launch, marketplace, hiring a new senior executive that, you did all the interview and reference checks in the world, but you don't really know if that person's going to work out. I mean, every business decision is like that.
That's true. This is one in which there's a huge committee of people looking at this and then writing down what we think are the uncertainties and then making some judgment about value of those. And this is one of those ones in which that, maybe they don't think about it that way, but that is what they're actually doing.
I just think you're doing that all the time.
I don't think there's enough data that you can ever get. And I did a study last year on analytics and why people aren't doing more around using analytics. And I found something very interesting in mid-sized companies. And in many of them, the bosses didn't want the analytics because they went on their gut.
Mm.
And when the gut goes against, or the data says your gut is wrong, to the boss, you've got problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that fundamentally, when you talk about this, is, you know, and if you're an accountant or you're an engineer, this is facts and figures.
Yeah.
Most business people at the executive levels, you know, there's a lot of gut involved in this, and egos get in here as well. And if you're trying to get egos left out of the room, good luck with that.
That's right.
So I think that that's just the nature of what we have to deal
yeah.
with. To your point, Jill, and I think that you know you try to figure these things out and ferret them out as best you can. But at the end of the day, we're dealing with people and egos, and some of them are big, and some of them aren't so big. And you know, and sometimes somebody is very sneaky. And, oh, they didn't have a big ego, and then it's done, and
yeah.
now you find out that you get burned.
That's right.
But you know, the fact of the matter is, analytics will never give you the answer either, because if you're looking at things like cultural alignment and how well, you don't have analytics for that. So a big part of the decision still has to be gut in the presence of insufficient information.
That's right.
Because the whole people component is like that.
Big.
And that's probably where in M&A, I think, because there's so much data that's collected and analyzed. There's so many professionals looking at it legally from the accounting perspective and the documents. And you get all tied up in that. And then sometimes the gut, the ability to kind of stand up and say, this just doesn't feel right. I think it's tougher in that environment in some respects. That takes real gut to say, just doesn't feel right.
But what Robert's talking about, too, are those that have more of the decision made on gut and less on analytics. That's where you run into real problems. You need a little bit more on the analytics and then go to the gut and realize the green light, red light is the gut stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like baseball now. You know, baseball's into big data and making decisions on players and who to play and who not to play. And in the old days, it was, you know, chewing tobacco and making a call, and not that way anymore.
But can you
just have a question to you and anybody else in the room. There's this figure that I have read about so many times. 70% of the acquisitions are done, fail to meet the objectives of the acquirers. And I read it so many times, I tell this to other people. And the question is that an urban myth, or is there actual data about this?
I believe through it. So,
what do you
got? I think 100% success rate.
Right.
So, 99%. So that's right. Having been on the side that bought company after company after company after company with very very success rate. So part of the problem is you analyze a business and you analyze their customers and their market and their funnel and, you know, what the revenue should be for the next 12 months. You probably don't believe anything after that anyway. And to me the challenge is when you take that company and you bolt it on to usually a bigger company, you've changed many things in a kind of intangible way. So the customer, I mean, even if you keep all the people, the customers aren't dealing with the same business anymore. And the marketplace has shifted. And so if you think you're going to do what that company said they were going to do, you are in big trouble. I mean, you're never going to meet those goals. I mean, I take that back. Never. Occasionally you'll get something that gets hit out of the ballpark. But the vast majority of the time, whatever that small company thought they were going to do, even if they were right, usually they're not, because they pumped up their numbers to make their price higher. So first you have to discount their numbers for that, and then you've got to sit there and go, well, now if they're part of us, different image, different market presence, does that add or subtract from what they're going to do? I really think that's where the stumbling comes. Everybody gets stars in their eyes, and they forget that that plan was based on a set of assumptions that are not good anymore. Chunk of them are no good anymore. So I really believe that's why they don't meet the expectations.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the expectations are based on assumptions that have gone away, and nobody even knows how to change those assumptions, much less their forecast. Part of the reason why the company I worked for was so good at it is after you've done a bunch of those, if you're smart, you get much better at figuring out what your expectations should really be.
Well, but going beyond that, I mean, that's knowledge gained within one company, but you know, probably, I'll think of the situation I was in some years ago where the company I worked for was acquired, a merger and then acquired ours. And you look back and you could say, you could tell this was gonna go wrong. Looking back, you could see all the signs in retrospect. So can't we take all that retrospective observation, retrospective knowledge, and somehow synthesize it to be able to get good at it?
So the way, Larry, the way I think of it is, and I do believe, I don't know whether it's 60%, 70%, or 80%, but it's a high percentage. And I think where you get success, I don't have the 220, but I've got over 40, is when you have a clear defined what your expectations are. You have a very clear, before the deal closes, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the whole integration side, on all aspects, the people side as well as the technology side as well as the customer side. So you've really thought through, and then you actually have a real focus team, if you will, on the integration with the continual feedback loop. And companies that do it well have a much higher rate of success, and they never stray from the whole thought about they know why they went in it to begin with, even though the world is changing around them, and they set those expectations realistically. But if you haven't been through a lot, or if you don't have people helping you get you to do those right things, then you know, I think the probability is very high that you never deliver, for whatever reason.
Good.
Wait, I have a comment on that, and then I want to get to this exercise.
Oh,
unless this is going to be fun. Trust me.
You have 10 minutes.
Yeah, I hear you. 11.
Soft close.
The one thing is that the data for the 70 to 80%, I believe, is with public companies, not private companies. So if you talk to private equity firms and venture capital firms that do acquisitions, not only for their own platform acquisitions, but for bolt-ons for their existing portfolio, I would bet you that they would say it was a lot higher. Okay, and that's how they're getting their 20.
The success.
Their success.
Oh,
success. The success.
I assume they would say that. Can you believe it?
Maybe so.
They would never admit
it. I didn't say it was true.
But see, I also think that's a very different situation,
exactly.
Because in some sense you're changing the shareholders, but you're not changing the management or the marketplace or anything else when it's a private equity acquirer.
PE firms come in and wipe it clean many times.
It's a very different thing.
You know?
Yep.
They
yep.
clean them out. Clean them out.
Yep.
Let me get out
okay,
of your
way. Okay, so with no, you can be right here.
Oh,
all
right.
Okay, so 10 minutes. I think there were some good questions. Rick, you asked it, is that we have some items on this sheet that we've all identified, again, without looking at these, are critical items for that you have to think about for acquisitions. And Ellen made the point is that every one of these items, we better start thinking about day one, not day 180. So what I want to do is this matrix, I want to put some of these items here on this matrix and determine, maybe this will help us to determine what items as board members we might want to concentrate on more than others day one. It's hard to concentrate on all these day one. It's hard to get all these right day one. So as board members, what do we want to spend our most time on? Okay, so I'm going to throw out an item to think about, and you'll tell me, you'll help.
Sure.
Where it's going to go in the matrix.
Why don't you read what's down the bottom, because
okay.
Everybody can
oh,
see
sorry
it.
About that.
Well, Ben, can you explain what the axes are? Kristen?
Yeah, I'm going to give an example, and then it'll help with the axes. So this says, if anybody can't see, it says, in terms of items, what's less flexible? Let's say less flexible to change. What's more flexible to change? What can only be done pre-deal, before you close the deal? What can be done possibly post-deal? So for example, let's just take one of the items, purchase price. Where would purchase price fit in this matrix? Okay, so purchase price, I would agree. Purchase price is pre-deal only, right? Purchase price is somewhat flexible.
Well, purchase prices are often adjusted post-deal.
Right.
As well, though.
So that helps with the flexibility. Okay, so this is the initial purchase price, so it's not, I don't want to get too confusing with adjustments and everything like that. Okay, how about another item? How about due diligence? Where would due diligence fall within this?
Hopefully three.
Well, you can't do hopefully three, but you can't do due diligence. Free. Due diligence is free. But due diligence is not, I would say three, but you move it over here because it's only pre-deal. Right? How about the initial, or how about the agreements? The agreements that we all have to live and breathe by. Where would that fall?
Two.
Pre-deal? Two? Are they, agreements are more flexible or less flexible? Once you come with an agreement, do you have the ability to change it?
No.
Okay.
Unless you have a good lawyer.
Ellen's right. She said less flexible, pre-deal.
Okay, a couple more and then we'll figure this out. How about somebody mentioned the core competency of the business, keeping up the core competency of the business? Pre-deal, post-deal?
Post.
Okay. Might be able to change the competencies of the business, change the product mix, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that less flexible or more flexible?
Depends on why you bought it.
That's true. We'll make a generic situation. Okay, what do you think, Glenn?
I think it's less.
Okay, you think less flexible. Hard to change.
Hard to change.
You might be able to change, it might not, but regardless, it's hard to change. Okay, we'll take two more and then we'll get to this. Management. Where would you put management? I can say thing.
Oh, it's number five.
I like that. Number five.
Yes, it's number five.
That means it's low.
And is the management you're asking about on the acquirer side or the
Yeah, this is only from this is only a decision making from the acquirer side.
Okay. So it's a four. Of course, you can change it.
Fire them all.
Okay.
That's good. That's not.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've all identified that these are pretty critical items to think about in terms of an acquisition. These are from an acquisition standpoint. We put them in some boxes. I realize the boxes can change depending on the company, and maybe this is an analysis that is done on a deal by deal basis. Okay. So what does this tell us? I don't know. I will argue that box one, let me use a different pen. Box one, you've got to get right. Got to get that right. I would argue that box two is important to get right. Okay. So these things we know, these are pre-deal only. You screw these up, you cannot change them. They are unchangeable. I realize there's purchase price adjustments, I realize there's certain agreements, but that goes in the agreements, the purchase price adjustments. So you gotta get that right. That helps this turn into this. I would say that these items, post-deal, you can change them. They can be fixed, but as Ellen pointed out, well, maybe they can't, but if you can fix them, they're hard. So can fix, but hard. That leaves this box that everybody, I didn't say a thing, everybody put management in this box. That might be the easiest thing to change. That might be the easiest item in this whole thing to come, you know, that you don't have to worry about in relative terms to the other items. Possibly.
See, I think that it's the easiest item to change, but that doesn't mean it's easy to manage the results of having changed it, right?
No question.
It's painful.
Right.
And that's prolonged,
that's right,
can be screwed up even more if you don't change it right.
Yeah.
In terms of particularly, for example, it can make the core competence go away if you muck it up.
So to her point, right, to your sort of opening point about like don't do a deal with bad people, the problem with the bad people at the top is not that, like, this says essentially almost contradicts that. You're like, well, if they're bad people, we can just toss them aside. The problem is, and this is what Jill opened with, is that the bad people will have almost certainly created a bad culture.
Yep.
And you can throw them away, you know, but you're going to have that bad culture left behind. And to change that, now we're up into three because we're talking about.
Yeah, unless you're buying intellectual property or some distribution channel, you know, which is unusual, and just doing a financial deal, that's okay. You can, you know, you can buy something from bad people because you're buying an inanimate issue.
Yeah. Right.
But
unless,
there aren't many,
by the way,
there aren't many
bad
like
bad customer relationships as
yeah,
a result of that,
also,
that you find
yeah.
out the customers are really pissed.
Sure.
Right. But I would argue though that the real conclusion is not where any one of these goes, but would be a statement to us that if we're in that situation as the board of the company, to go through an exercise like this,
mm-hmm.
and
that's
say,
the point.
Well, okay, well, for this particular deal, where does the
that's right.
factors lie?
That's the point.
And then where should we focus our efforts?
That's right. These changed a bit depending on the company, depending on the type of company, who the acquirer is, what the target is, what the fiduciary responsibility of you as a board member. But you notice that if you are able to create a matrix like this and put things in neat boxes, which can never be done, you'll know as a board member, possibly, what areas you should concentrate on that particular deal more than others. Because you can't concentrate on everything. You can't get everything right. So which ones per deal can you get right? And those are the ones that you should work on the most. Whether it's this, or you want to put this box in there, depending on the deal. And the other ones, maybe work on less, or maybe you outsource those type of things.
So I think that, to me, the things that get neglected, and maybe they're part of diligence, that can really bite in the ass, if you will, are things like environmental contamination liability that doesn't get looked at, or
that's a big legal due diligence piece.
IP disputes that
right.
don't get looked at. I mean, there are pieces that are down in the nits that have enormous
That's,
if you don't.
Right. We do
courts
those.
Often,
those are important.
I think don't even know what those are.
Right.
So these
so
are
that,
all the normal things, but there are some of those things that I think really need to be pointed out.
Right. Yeah, things like EPA issues are pretty straightforward legally, but that's why there's every international accounting and law firm that's out there. The monies that are being made in post-acquisition dispute resolution is incredible right now. It is absolutely incredible because of what Larry said and what you've been talking about.
And by the way, cybersecurity needs to get really added to that list. So if you're buying this business,
it's everything right now.
Where are they in all of that?
Don't,
do you even dare connect them to your network?
Don't use your debit card. That's all I can tell you.
That's right.
That's what I've been told. I said, give us one great cybersecurity expert. I said, give us one example of what we should be doing on a personal level. He said, never use your debit card. I said, okay.
So, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Craig.
So, you know, is it Robert? I can't read.
Robert. Yeah.
Had it right off the bat.
Yeah.
It's a strategy that would cover every bit of this and everything around the room. And I would imagine everybody. We're talking like we don't use checklists, but everybody does use checklists, right? They would have EPA, all these other issues. I mean, now you might have a bad due diligence team, but this all should be
right.
addressed in your overall plan. I would think that'd be more on the technical side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But isn't he? But in your plan, you're determining again what you're spending your time on, what you're outsourcing, and what's not important.
Sure.
Okay. So you have a checklist. Everybody's got a checklist on an acquisition or a checklist on their to-do every day, right? But there's always 100 items on it. So if you went through 100 items, which are the 10 items that you're going to do personally, which are the 10 items you're going to have somebody else do, and which are the 10 items that you're not going to worry about that day?
I mean,
and the problem is if you get that order wrong, you might be screwed.
And so that's when we need to bring in Grant Thornton.
That's right. Very good. Very good.
I'm glad you said that.
Dispute resolution. Very good.
Now, let's have one more question, and then it's 6 o'clock. And what that means is those of you who need to leave, want to leave, feel free to do so. Those of you who want to continue to stay, feel free to do so. Any questions for our guests? No? Thank you very much. Thank you. Feel free to stay if you'd like.
It's a bee, I'm sorry. Did I get the rest of it right?
Yeah.
B-I-N-D-I?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely. Usually I see Y or something else.
Right, right. I had a feeling. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I'm actually a client of yours.
Oh, how are you?
Good. You know I'm a client, right?
Yes.
But I've actually just introduced Grant into one of my companies that was connected to So let me give you a call. This is great,
by the way. Sure. It's a little discussion item. Yeah, we're having the.
I know, I forgot Joel. Yeah, I love Joel.
Isn't he a great guy? He's going to be retiring.
Yeah.
We both are. So find me a board position. Oh my God, stop. It was great to meet you, Ellen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I saw your press release.
How are you?
How are you?
Good to see you. I know you met a couple of partners.
Sure.
That's
good. We're going to get some
digital.
I'm definitely not in this field. I've got a
great website.
But it was
never good.
You
got to think about it some way differently. A lot of the stuff we just made up. I'm sure other people have other ways that they're thinking up too, but
good trip.
I like to think that that's the case.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Sure.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Is that okay for you?
Yeah,
I got my some stuff.
Why aren't you coming out and having fun with us?
Rick, I got a scoop. Rick, I'll see you.
Those are really good questions.
Thanks, Bob. See you at the AGBS Howard Lindley School.
Okay, well, give me some dates about where we can do
right.
This thing.
All right. That's all mine. That's all the difference.
John, thanks for coming.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. So, are you doing okay?
Yeah.
Larry, thank you.
Well, thank you. Those are awesome. Thank you very much.
We'll think of something.
Okay.
That's proprietary information. We'll license that out.
We'll do another slide.
And in some cases, maybe it's a direct.
Assuming the audio.
We're really focused on serving up certain.
That's great.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
Looking forward to seeing you.
That's great.
Don't mingle.
So I always think that's the case, you know, so.
I would tell you if you want.
Thank you. My apologies again for being so late.
Not a problem.